funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does peer pressure do to us, and what might it do for us if we apply it properly to our most pressing social problems? While we are warned from an early age about the dangers of doing things just because our friends are doing them, peer pressure isn't inherently good or bad. As my guest today has learned, our desire for the approval of friends, neighbors, and colleagues can result in very positive changes if what they're seeking happens to be good for us. Tina Rosenberg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and MacArthur Fellow. Her new book is called Join the Club: How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. Tina, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
We could probably spend the entire hour talking just about this question, but I'll throw it out there anyway. Why are we driven to conform to what the people around us are doing?
Because we're humans. I mean, that's part of it. It's part of our evolutionary makeup. It helps us to propagate the species. And I think it's something that everybody instinctively knows in their bones, that we really crave belonging to a group, and the respect of that group is very important to us, and we will do a lot of things to win that.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, all of our fears about the negative effects of peer pressure, which do exist, tend to make us forget all the ways that it can be good for the way we move through the world.
Yeah, we've tended to think of it purely as a negative. I mean, every parent is afraid of peer pressure for their kids. It's what makes them turn to drugs or crime or violent gangs. But when your kids have a good peer group and it helps them do stay on the straight path in life, we tend not to think of it as peer pressure. We tend to think of it as excellence in parenting instead.
Yeah, it's all about us.
Yeah. So we often ignore the good side of peer pressure. But the fact is that if we use it with purpose and intentionality to help people join a more positive group, it can have a very strong effect. The example that I think most people are familiar with is Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because there you have not only individuals committing to quit drinking, but you have people coming together and sort of looking each other in the eye on a regular basis and saying, this is how we're quitting drinking.
That's right. It's both support and accountability. I think both sides are important.
You know what I thought was fascinating about the section where you write about AA is this idea of sponsorship. As people may be aware, when you join Alcoholics Anonymous, you're usually partnered with someone who has been in the program longer and successfully. Talk about who that partnership benefits most.
Not who you think. There's been numerous studies about this in the context of AA and also among relationships between people who newly are released from prison.
Mm-hmm.
And they're given a mentor who's also a released prisoner, but with a couple more years outside. The person who benefits most from the relationship is the mentor, not the mentee. It helps them really to reinforce their own commitment, to feel a sense of efficacy and that they're doing something good and useful. And it's really positive. It's also positive for the protege, but not quite as positive.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense that at that point, suddenly they realize if they slip up, they're not just letting themselves down, but this new person who is even more vulnerable.
That's a very good point.
Mm-hmm. So we all know that certain things that we're going to talk about this hour are bad for us or good for us. We all know we should avoid smoking and risky sex. We should eat right. We should demand accountable democratic leadership. Why isn't information alone enough to make most of us change our behavior?
Well, we've really found with the history of public health messages and other kinds of messages that are intended to put us on the right path that information alone does not work. Fear also is something that tends not to work. And information doesn't work in large part because, first of all, you're telling people things they already know.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, people will not believe the information unless it comes from someone who's credible. So the important part of that equation is hearing that message from somebody who's just like me but has managed to change their life. Then information works. But it works because it's based on identification with someone else.
One thing I found fascinating was this campaign to keep teenagers from smoking. And the way it worked, I guess, in Florida, was that anti-smoking activists worked to position teenagers against the tobacco companies.
That's right. Well, teen smoking has really confounded us for a long time. And in the late 1990s, it was astronomically high. More than 35% of all high school seniors were smokers.
Hmm.
And we didn't know what to do about it. We'd tried all sorts of things. Information clearly didn't work. Every teenager knew that cigarettes were bad for you. In fact, they overestimated the dangers of smoking. They thought it was actually more dangerous than it was. but that was clearly part of its appeal. So the state of Florida found that it suddenly had some money to spend on this question because of the big settlement of the lawsuit with the tobacco companies, and it hired an ad agency that knew nothing about public health but had done quite well in marketing to teenagers. And they sat down and they said, why is it that teens smoke? For a teenager, a cigarette is not a delivery system for nicotine. It's a delivery system for rebellion. Hmm. It's a way to tell adults, you don't tell me what to do. I'm my own person. I'm autonomous. And it's a way to look cool to your peers by doing that. So they thought, how can we give teens that same satisfaction of rebellion, but in a more positive way? And they decided that let's form these clubs and have this advertising campaign of teens rebelling against the manipulations of the tobacco companies, mm-hmm. which are trying to hook teens to smoke. And this was just a brilliant ad campaign. They had TV spots that were written by the teenagers themselves, and a lot of them were based around prank phone calls. They would show kids making prank phone calls to, for example, advertisers who worked for the tobacco companies. Or they had a road trip where a bunch of kids drove from Florida up to Richmond, Virginia, which is the headquarters of Philip Morris. And they stopped at the gate and they asked the guard, can we see the Marlboro Man? And the guard, who was totally clueless, said, oh, I'm sorry, but he's dead. Because, in fact, the actor who had played the Marlboro Man in the TV commercials had just died right. of lung cancer. And they got this all on tape, and they put it on the air. And it was supplemented with clubs in every county in Florida where kids staged actions against the tobacco companies, like street theater, like they'd have die-ins and, you know, draw their outlines on the with chalk on the sidewalk. And this was hugely successful. Over the next 2 years, Florida saw the single biggest drop in teen smoking the U.S. had ever seen.
So suddenly it becomes something like you're with those awful tobacco companies and not with us kids if you decide to pick up a cigarette.
Well, yeah, that's right. That's right. It was the sense of, you know, kids love to rebel against their parents. Well, these people, the tobacco companies, they're even less cool than your parents.
And most kids had the sense, or teenagers had the sense, that this campaign, the genesis of it was actually with their peers, as opposed to thinking that it was someone hired to figure out a solution to this.
They were really careful to involve teenagers at every step. And they made sure that the spots themselves were either written by teens or very closely vetted by teens, to the point where when they did focus groups and asked teenagers, who's paying for this campaign, teenagers thought it was other teenagers. Hmm. Nobody got the right answer, which was the boring old Florida Department of Health.
Let's talk about teen peer pressure in South Africa, which has tried valiantly to get a handle on its HIV infection rate. A public health campaign there took its cues not from the standard sort of PSA protocol, but from a soft drink campaign.
That's right. South Africa, in the late 1990s, which seems to be a really good time for Join the Club strategy, since a lot of the stories in my book begin then, they had this explosive AIDS problem that I think now we all know about. But they had not been doing much about it. They were just transitioning out from apartheid, and it was not high on their to-do list, although in retrospect it probably should have been. But they finally decided to get serious about it, and they designed a campaign to keep teenagers away from risky sex that didn't rely on giving them information, because teens in South Africa knew how they would catch AIDS, and they knew the devastation that it caused. Mm-hmm. And it also didn't rely on scaring them, which is the traditional campaign when you're talking about AIDS. What it did instead was give them a new peer group of people to identify with who were making more positive choices. And they called it Love Life, which is a deliberate pun. And if you went to their website, and you can still go, it's still going, you can see that it looks like a fashion magazine website. It's got stories about pop stars and dating advice and fashion. It talks very little about HIV and AIDS. Because what they decided teens needed was not information, but a reason to apply that information to themselves, and role models of people just like them who had applied that information to themselves.
What does it take, Tina, to ensure that you recruit the correct kids who are sort of influence leaders within their own group?
I'm not certain you always have to recruit the correct kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is true that if you're looking for the power group in any school, then they're going to be probably the most effective people. But, you know, all of us have peer groups. And as adults, we tend not to think of being susceptible to peer pressure because we found the peer group we're comfortable with. So it feels like the choices we make come from inside. But if we're not comfortable with that peer group, then we'll switch to another one that we are comfortable with.
Yeah.
But it has to be the people around us, the people who are like us, but it doesn't necessarily have to be rock stars and superheroes or their equivalent in our group.
You know, it occurred to me reading through this book, you know, when you think about teenagers engaging in risky behaviors and, say, drinking and experimenting with drugs, maybe it's this positive peer pressure that when most of us get out of school, we decide this is not the way we want to live our lives.
That has something to do with it. I mean, teenagers, there's an extra factor in there, which is that is the year, that's the period of time in your life when you rebel. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to. That's how your personality is formed. And also, there's biological reasons for it. Your brain is still in formation, and no parent will be surprised to learn that one of the last parts of the brain to be fully mature is the part that regulates judgment.
Mm-hmm.
But teens are a little weak on that.
So is there anything we can do as parents to, I mean, it seems like the worst thing we could possibly do is try to steer our kids into a positive peer group.
Well, it's probably not going to hurt, but it won't be that effective. It might be effective. It might be effective. If it's overt and you're choosing your teen's friends for them, no way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you allow that child to explore and get involved and try different activities and find one that they like with a group of people they like, then that can be effective. You know, I have three children, and I am now much more in tune with the importance of helping my daughters, you know, find kids to hang around with who are kids who have really, you know, positive values and good behavior.
Another thing that you found was that peer pressure can work when you're trying to help students succeed in hyper-competitive environments. But in some cases, it helps to ensure that the student is in the right peer group. Would you talk about what happened at Berkeley in the 70s when
Yes.
somebody noticed that Black and Latino students were struggling in calculus in college, even though they had done great in high school?
Yes. This is also something that's been very successful at the University of Texas in Austin. This was noticed by a graduate student in math at the time who was really puzzled because these were kids who had been recruited to Berkeley who had done really well in math and were taking a course that many of them had already taken, and they were flunking. And the question was why? Why were minority students not doing well in calculus? And it was a really important question because calculus is the gateway to a career in the hard sciences or in math or medicine. So if you don't have calculus, you're not gonna have a career in the sciences. So this grad student, whose name was Yuri Treisman, who's now in Austin, decided to study two groups of kids, a group of kids who did very well in math and a group of kids who did very poorly. And he spent 18 months on this project, and at the end he found out that the most important difference between them was that the kids who did well studied in groups, and the kids who did poorly tended to study alone.
Hmm.
And so what he did was he set up special discussion sections. You go to the same calculus lecture as everyone else, but you, for your discussion section, you have a special one that has extra challenging problems. This is not remedial in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You're working on harder stuff than other people, but you group yourselves into threes and fours, and you put your desks together in a circle, and you teach each other. And the grad student who's running it is instructed not to answer any questions.
Hmm.
The grad student's job is to help the students come up with the answers. And these were wildly successful. Kids in these classes did much, much better. At Berkeley at one point, blacks and Latinos in these classes ended up scoring three-quarters of a grade point higher than whites and Asians who were not in these classes.
Let me jump in here so we can take a quick break. My guest this hour is Tina Rosenberg. Her new book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. We'd love to hear from you now at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and MacArthur Fellow Tina Rosenberg. Her new book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. If you've got a question about how this works or an example of how you've seen it work, we would love to hear from you now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Tina, what is so magical about putting students in small groups together to study?
Well, several things. First of all, you have to know something pretty well to be able to teach it to someone else. So it forces you to really get your stuff straight. But more importantly, it gives kids the opportunity to freely ask questions without fear of looking dumb in front of a large group. And this is a real inhibiting factor, and it's especially inhibiting for minorities who worry about being stereotyped as being dumb or about being stereotyped as being bad in math. So it's easy to ask questions when there's four people around a table and the person you're asking is a student. The other way it works, and there was a study done by a PhD student at University of Texas that showed that the more friends you had in your class, the better you did in math. One of the problems that black students have when they come to college is that they tend to keep their social life and their academic life separate. And with classes like these, you started to develop math friends, and you had this group of people with whom it was okay to like math. And that's had a big effect.
Yeah, it seems like that could also have an impact on the dropout rate that we struggle with, particularly in this state. Suddenly, kids get to this place where a certain segment of them think school is not cool. And even if you sort of like it, you can't say that out loud.
Right, that's right. And I think it's funny that a lot of kids who are involved in something that's negative know that they're involved in something that's negative and wish that they could stop. But socially, they can't afford to.
I thought this was really interesting. We're moving away from teenagers here, but you write about this mega church in Chicago where it took a little bit of experimenting to figure out how this might work best. Turned out the most successful Bible study groups were not formed around common interests, but around geographic proximity.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think almost everyone who's been to church knows about the small group movement.
Mm-hmm.
Every church that's sort of bigger than 10 people has decided that you need to divide into smaller groups to study the Bible and to form a relationship with other people so you can deepen your own spiritual maturity. And this was happening as well at Willow Creek Community Church, which is a giant mega church in South Barrington, Illinois, which is a far suburb of Chicago. But they polled their membership, and they found that people were not satisfied with these small groups. They were feeling that they did not get close enough to the people in them to really feel comfortable revealing themselves and growing spiritually that way. And part of it was that, you know, yes, you were in a small group with other single men or other recovering alcoholics, or they had small groups for vacuum cleaner salesmen and for the big church, and for airline pilots who work out of O'Hare. And you would have to drive 45 minutes to get to your small group, and you go once every 2 weeks, and you have to get a babysitter, and the temptation is to stay home. So there were various reasons that this was not a lot of time, and there was not a lot of closeness going on. So Willow Creek did something radical. They reorganized. They brought in a pastor named Randy Frazee, who had been in Texas and now is back in a San Antonio church. And his idea was organize these groups by proximity. You want people in your group who live pretty much right next to you.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could not do meetings with them. You can do life with them.
Hmm.
And the expectation was you would have some meals together. You would see each other dropping your kids off at Brownies. You would plan outings together as families. Your kids would be friends. That you would really develop the closeness that would allow people to feel comfortable revealing their true selves. It's odd that this is a very conservative church in some ways, and it was asking people to form what was in essence a commune, which was strange. And a lot of people at Willow Creek were not comfortable with it and didn't like it. There was a big backlash against it, and a lot of people went back to the old-style small groups. But some people stayed with this kind of group. It's called a table group because it was built around having a meal. And I followed two of those groups. And they really have gone through an astonishing transformation. They really credit this style of group with really satisfying spiritual growth that they felt they weren't getting the other way.
Tina Rosenberg is my guest. Her new book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. That's where we hear from Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Hi. I don't know that you get to this in your book, but could you at least apply what you've learned to the use of these kind of peer pressure for political alliances, whether political parties or constellations or combinations, say at a national level, because they can be used for insidious purposes or liberating purposes.
There's lots of politics in the book, actually, Tina.
Scott, that is such an excellent question, and I'm so glad you asked it. Peer pressure. I think we're all aware of how peer pressure can be used for insidious purposes in politics. Witness, for example, the number of Germans who joined the Nazi Party. But it can also be employed really, really productively and creatively. I spend a lot of time in the book talking about one of my favorite stories, which is the fall of Slobodan Milosevic, the dictator of Yugoslavia. And a large part of what brought him down was a student movement called Otpor, which means resistance in Serbian. And they began, again, in 1998, and they were 11 kids at Belgrade University, and they decided they were going to topple Slobodan Milosevic. Everyone thought they were completely insane, of course. And they set out to say, what is it we need people to do? We don't need to give Serbs information. They know that they live under a cruddy government, and their lives are full of suffering. What they need is a motivational reason to get out of their houses and do something about it. So let's make it a party that everyone wants to join. So they decided they would do nothing that other politicians do. There were no speeches. There were very few marches, in part because there were only 11 people. And they instead relied on street theater and pranks and humor and really great music and graphics. And they allowed people to have this sense of danger because there was a very high chance you would be arrested if you were a member of Otpor, but you wouldn't be mistreated badly. You would stay in the police station for a couple of hours and then be released. But in the meantime, Otpor would assemble this crowd outside of its members and journalists and your friends, and you would come out of the police station and you would give an interview to the opposition journalists, and then you would go out with your friends for beer, and the next day everybody wanted your phone number, and you felt like James Bond. I mean, this was the party that everybody wanted to go to. And they went in 2 years from 11 people to 70,000, probably more, but they had stopped counting. And they were crucial in the fall of Milosevic.
And you have people literally sort of tumbling over each other to be arrested so that they can experience this.
People competed to be arrested. It was a really big thing. These were boys, by the way. I mean, girls were not into this. But I met one guy in the city of Novi Sad who'd been arrested at least 17 times.
Tina Rosenberg is my guest. Our number, 1-800-933-5372. We'll go next to Plano and speak with Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just want to make a comment about you talking about small groups in churches. That's essentially how the Methodist Church got started, was small community groups that met in homes that eventually formed the Methodist Church.
Do you want to comment on that?
I did not know that that's how the Methodist Church got started. I think there's a lot of home churches, and they, you know, when a church is very small, it doesn't need small groups because it essentially is a small group.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of how to give people a rich experience in community is one that really bedevils most large churches. And I'm sure that Methodist churches today are struggling with this.
Yeah, it is interesting that we've moved toward these gigantic churches, which have certainly some advantages, and they have different kinds of services and many different kinds of people. But there is that sense that you want to be able to look across the aisle and wave to somebody that you know.
Yes. I mean, you know, people join church in large part for the community. And then God comes along later.
How is this being undertaken with what's going on in North Africa and in the Middle East right now? And are you seeing, do these look like peer movements to you, like the social cure at work?
Some of them are, and it's not a coincidence. These Serb kids who were in Otpor started a group that now trains democracy movements from around the world. And they teach others their tactics. And they worked in around 50 countries teaching dissidents how to use these tactics to grow a social movement. And among the movements they've trained were the April 6th movement in Egypt, which was very influential. And a lot of the tactics you saw in Tahrir Square came directly from the Serbs. But one interesting thing about the Serbs and their tactics is they were indirectly creating democracy. What they were directly creating was activism, protagonists, getting people to stop seeing themselves as passive victims and see themselves as dashing heroes. So they were really learning how to mobilize a social movement. And the goal of their social movement was toppling a dictator. But it doesn't have to be toppling a dictator. It can be saving Darfur or fighting climate change or fighting corruption or any other goal that you have.
There is also obviously an element of peer pressure and sort of social force in things like microlending. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, microlending is probably the most important new concept to come along in poverty fighting of the last 40 years. And what it does is it lends very, very small amounts of money, like $10, $20, to extremely poor people who have no other form of collateral and are not considered creditworthy, so they can start businesses. And when it began, the big question was, how do you make sure that people will pay back these loans? And they decided the way to do it was peer pressure. They formed people into borrowing groups, and mostly women, and some of these microlending groups only lend to women. And your reputation was at stake. If you did not pay back your loan, at first, the Grameen Bank, which is the most famous of these groups, at first Grameen had the rule that if one of your members of the group doesn't pay back the loan, nobody can get another loan. But after a while, they discarded that. They decided it wasn't necessary. Peer pressure was enough. People wanted to safeguard their reputations and their position in the group, so they pay back their loans. And it's peer pressure that makes people creditworthy.
And I would imagine that same pressure, that same force encourages women to say, this really worked well for me. You should get involved and try this for yourself and start a small business.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, it's not the message that counts. It's who's delivering the message. And the most effective person to deliver a message is someone just like you who's changed their life.
I know that part of the reason that microlending efforts focus on women is because of research that shows in the developing world, or perhaps in the world at large, when women control the family purse strings, children tend to fare better and there's more money spent on food and less on alcohol. And of course, we're making generalizations here, but there's
research. That's right. Yeah, you're right.
But are women different? Do we respond more to peer influence than men do, or just simply in a different way?
I don't know the answer to that. It's a really good question. It seems as though women are more social creatures than men, but it may just be that we assimilate peer pressure in a different way.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us with an example or a question by sending email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we're in San Angelo with Roger. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Chris. This is Roger. I'm from San Angelo, Texas. About 15, 16 years ago, our church created a number of small life groups, never more than 12 in the group. We were a very disparate lot, but we gathered once a week for a meal, for fellowship, for Bible study, and frequently for service out in the community, serving meals, preparing meals, any number of things. And one of the things that has struck me about that group is we have grown, and our membership has evolved over the years, but we develop a very, very close affection and a lot of compassion for one another, even though there are many things about which we do not agree. And it's created a bond that to me is just amazing. And as I was listening to some of your folks call in, it just triggered the thought on that.
Well, I really appreciate your call, Roger. Thank you so much. And, you know, Tina, it sounds like the church that you were describing, and Roger made the interesting point that they're not exactly alike, the people who form bonds in these ways, but those things become less important, which is something that would seem that all of society could do better if we could stop focusing on the things we disagree on.
That's right. That's a very good point.
I'm curious about this. So much of our communication now with people we feel like we know well, but also with people we hardly know at all, takes place in digital form, online. And I wonder about, is there a greatly diminished influence of peer pressure when our only communication is mediated by a computer or a cell phone or something?
I think that there's a greatly diminished incidence of relationship with other people. It's wider than just the influence of peer pressure. And relationship with other people is something that keeps us healthy and happy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the problem is bigger than its effect on peer pressure. But I struggled with the question of whether you could have a join the club, social cure style, positive peer pressure example purely in digital form. And my feeling right now, and I may be proved wrong about this later, is that you cannot. The Internet is very useful as a platform for telling people about your Join the Club solution and giving them information about where to go and when, but I do not yet have evidence that it is strong enough to be as good as in-person relationships at helping people to change their lives.
Well, you know, it's funny. Sometimes people, they click like on something or they forward something along, and then they feel like they've taken action as opposed to actually doing something out in the real world.
Well, the Egyptian kids who were rebelling against Mubarak learned this. I mean, they had this incredible Facebook group, 70,000 people almost overnight, but they didn't know what to do with it. Life isn't lived on Facebook. Life is lived in the street. Revolutions aren't made on Facebook. Revolutions are made in the street. And just because you're organized online does not mean you're organized offline at all.
Tina Rosenberg is my guest. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and MacArthur Fellow and author of the new book, Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. We'd love to hear more of your questions and more of your examples of how this might have worked in your own life. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tina Rosenberg. Her new book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Another way that it occurred to me that this sort of is happening in our society today is this question of texting or being online while we're trying to drive. And initially, when everybody had this capability, people were doing it and sort of laughing about it. And yeah, it distracts me. But now we've seen a spate of laws say that you can't do it. But it seems like the disapproval of other people saying, wait, you were sending a text while you were driving through a school zone is more powerful than the fear of getting a ticket.
I agree. Yes, the law is the law, but what teenagers will do is something completely different. And the way to get people to quit this is by having it become really uncool behavior. Now, how can we make it uncool? That I'm not sure I can tell you on the fly. I know that it's important to do that. Perhaps a campaign that this is not going to be something that's going to be susceptible to a prank-style approach, I think, because it's more serious. I don't know. I mean, a campaign that features some kids in the school who have lost friends or family members due to distracted driving.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that the message is coming from them. That's one possibility.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Mari in Fort Worth. Hi, Mari.
Hi. I have a question about social media and how real people are. I feel like everyone's lives are so fantastic on Facebook, Twitter, especially Facebook, you know, even people posting comments and liking everyone. Everything just seems like it's such a perfect world. And and I guess that's my problem with it, is it's not real. But I have gone to forums before where I actually was going through some medical procedures about a year ago, and I found so much hope and happiness in how kind everyone was. So I guess it's kind of, to me, I'm not really sure exactly what to believe and how real people are.
Well, this is a great advantage of meeting people face to face. You do get a sense from them of what they're really like. That's a big part of having the social cure work in a face-to-face setting, because you do feel comfortable enough to let down your guard, and people support each other, and you feel like you can call someone out when they've strayed from the path that you all want to be on. And that's something that's much harder to do online. You're right. I mean, people have these personas online. There's no reason to have to show yourself.
We've talked about different parts of the world just in this conversation, but I'm curious as to whether this manifests itself in different ways according to culture.
Yes, it does. And one of the things, one of the stories in the book that I was really most hit hard by is the story of some of the people who are probably among the most downtrodden people on the planet. And it was a group of women in rural India, a very, very poor part of India. And these women were from the Dalit, or untouchable, caste, which meant they were at the bottom of society. Most of them were illiterate. All of them that I met had been married by the age of 13, and one had been married by the age of 2.5. Hmm. And these were people who literally kept their gaze to the ground, and their culture said that they had to carry a little broom to erase their footprints as they walked, because someone else who stepped in those footprints would be contaminated by them.
And this is all despite the fact that this has been illegal for 60 years.
This is illegal, yes. In India, it is illegal to practice untouchability, yet it is widely practiced. Mm-hmm. And these women are still discriminated against. So the program that I write about was this astonishing program that started in 1970, and it was founded by a pair of Indian doctors, Raj and Maybelle Arole, who are husband and wife. And they went to a very poor part of India, and they wanted to improve village health. And they knew there was no chance that they were going to be able to bring doctors to this part of the world. And it turned out that nurses were also impossible to lure to these villages. And the ones that they could bring to the villages weren't very good. They didn't do a good job because they were very comfortable with top-down curative medicine, but they weren't very good at helping people to understand how to do preventive medicine, which is really the basis of rural health. Mm-hmm. Most of rural health problems can be solved by better nutrition, better sanitation, and a change in practices that are discriminatory. For example, the cultural norm in that part of India that you shouldn't feed a pregnant woman very much. So nurses weren't good at this. They weren't comfortable with it, and they didn't have credibility in their villages. So they decided instead to go in completely the opposite direction and work with the most downtrodden women, the women I describe, and train them to be their village health workers. So they asked each village to choose a woman, and they brought them to this central campus, which is called Jamked, which is also the name of the program, and taught them the skills that they needed to teach people about how to take care of their own health. But they found out quickly that teaching them the skills was not the hard part. That was easy. What was much harder was giving them the confidence to be able to think of themselves as a person who had something to offer their neighbors and could gain their neighbors' respect.
Yeah.
So what they did was they used peer pressure. Each woman who was new would go back to the village with a woman who had been in the program for a few years, and she could watch her work. And she could see, this is my future. This woman started out just like me, and look at her now. Look at how bold and assertive she is and how respected she is. People in the village call her doctor. Hmm. And then every week, and this is still going on, 40 years later, the women come back to Jamked Tuesdays and spend the night. And they study a health topic every week, but probably more important is renewing these bonds with their sisters in this group. And it's a hugely successful program that still goes on today and has trained people all over the world.
And the effect is not only profound on the women who are being trained and going back and providing these services, but the broader community suddenly says, oh, there's no reason to disrespect people like this.
That's right. They're catalysts. They're trained to become catalysts and change their communities. And health in these communities has greatly improved. For example, virtually all births are attended. Nobody gives birth without the help of someone trained in these villages. You know, kids are breastfed right away instead of waiting for 5 days. Nutrition's better. People boil their water. They understand the importance of getting rid of standing water so you don't attract mosquitoes. All the health indicators for these villages are much, much, much better. And it's because these messages of preventive health care come from people who are just like me. You know, you understand me because you're my neighbor and you live the same way. So when you say it, it has more credibility than even when a doctor says it. Doctor is too up in the atmosphere for me. I'll believe someone who lives on my block.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Paul in Dallas. Hello, Paul.
Hi. I had a question for your speaker, and I do apologize. I forget your name.
Tina.
Thank you. I am wondering if you did any sort of study or anything associated with peer pressure and another aspect of the Internet, which is massively multiplayer online games such as World of Warcraft and that sort of a thing. I have several friends that I've known for years. I do consider them actual friends of mine. I even had a couple of them move from halfway across the country to share an apartment with me a while ago. And I'm still friends with them now. And I'm wondering if you looked at the effect of games like that that encourage more of an interaction than just something like Facebook where you're just posting what you're doing at the moment or something like that.
You know, I didn't look at that, but you raise a really important question. It sounds like this is a completely different type of interaction on the Internet. So almost your avatars are being friends with each other.
It might be stronger,
but I don't know anything about that.
It must be interesting as you sort of get into this, and I know that you've written on a variety of really different wide topics, that, you know, each time you learn something, there's another avenue that you want to chase down.
Well, when I started this book, I didn't the only example of positive peer pressure I probably could have come up with was Alcoholics Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see it everywhere, and I see the potential for it everywhere. Now that I'm wearing my little peer pressure glasses, I just see all these other social problems that can be attacked this way.
Are there any that you feel like are intractable or at least couldn't really be affected by this social problem specifically that you've sort of tried to fit the puzzle in and it doesn't work for you?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's many, many problems where you're really not going to solve them by getting people to change their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And those problems are probably not susceptible to this. But one of the lessons I learned is that problems that you don't think have anything to do with behavior can be susceptible to this. For example, calculus. Who would have thought that your success in calculus is a behavioral problem? Or, bringing down a dictator. Who would have thought that peer pressure would help in bringing down Slobodan Milosevic? I mean, if you thought of it, you'd probably throw it out because you would say, well, who are his peers, other dictators? They're not going to tell him to step down. But that's not how it works. Peer pressure can be a catalyst to create movements that can then affect politics on a wider basis.
We have an email here from Marlis in Trophy Club who wants to know about the difference between large high schools as compared with smaller high schools with regard to the effect that peer pressure might have on students.
I do not know the answer to that question. Does Marlin have an opinion?
No, it's just an email here, and
okay.
That's all we've got, and I'm not sure we'll have time to hear back, but we can perhaps hear in a couple of minutes. Talk about this. What can we do if we feel like we've got a great idea and we want to influence other people?
Well, it depends on what your idea is. If this on a personal level, this strategy is most effective to help you change your own behavior.
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
Michael Jackson, the man in the mirror.
Did not work for him on a personal level,
I don't want to speculate. But if, for example, anything that you could consider a New Year's resolution mm-hmm. will work better with peer pressure. It'll help. It can help you if you can find someone else who also wants to eat more healthfully, go out and run at 6 o'clock in the morning, save more money, go to church more regularly. Just about anything you can think of that you want to do, you know you want to do, but sometimes you just can't bring yourself to do it, peer pressure can help you do that. And one thing I'm very intrigued by right now, where this can really take on national importance, is in the issue of health care, because many, many of the problems in our health system today and a lot of unnecessary money and unnecessary death and unnecessary sickness comes from our inability to adhere to our treatment regimens.
Mm-hmm.
We're very bad at taking our pills the way the doctors tell us to, and we're very bad at doing everything else the doctors tell us to do, like quitting smoking or changing our diets. And there is a solution to this problem that's been proven to work.
Oh, this is the thing in China?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, it is. It's called DOTS, and which stands for Directly Observed Treatment, short course, and it was invented to help tuberculosis patients stick to their six-month regimen of treatment. Not short at all, so short course is really a misnomer. But what it does is it gets somebody to come to your house and watch you swallow your medicine every day. And it can be a friend or a family member or a community health worker. And when it came to China, cure rates for TB rose from 50% to 94%.
Hmm.
It is hugely effective, and it is hugely cost-effective. In fact, it's usually free. And it's not used in America, I think, because doctors are uncomfortable in America dealing with adherence and may feel like it's too intrusive for us in a middle-class society. But I don't agree with that. I don't see why. I mean, you get a bottle of medicine and it says take with food on it. Why not get one that says take with spouse?
Yeah, to make sure that there's someone, even in the sense you don't want to disappoint the other person, but you
that's
also...
That's exactly how it works. They're holding, they're supporting you and holding you accountable.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes so much sense, even when you consider that many people don't, you know, when they get a diagnosis, it hits them so hard that they can't even fully process the information they've just received.
And it really helps to talk to someone who's just had that diagnosis and is maybe a few months further down the road than you are.
So have you changed the way you talk to your own kids about peer pressure?
I've learned from them, I think, more than they've been listening to me. I don't talk to them about peer pressure. I guess that's one change. Mm-hmm. I'm not sort of wagging my finger at them, telling them, don't hang out with this person. But they're too young for that yet. I mean, mm-hmm. I still get to control their lives.
Yeah, I know. Enjoy those precious moments while they last. Tina Rosenberg is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and MacArthur Fellow. Her new book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. Tina, such an interesting idea, really interesting book. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.